Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
On today's show, the brilliant Australian actor Rob Carlton joins me to discuss his new live show, Willing Participant. My name is Justin Hamilton, and I wish someone would cast me as a thug here on Big Squid. Welcome to today's episode of Big Squid. This is a scorcher of an interview with Rob Carlton, one of Australia's great actors. You may know him for playing Kerry Packer in the Paper Giants miniseries. He's currently starring in the TV miniseries Boy Swallows Universe, which is appearing on Netflix. And at the moment, he is about to bring his new show, or I should say take his new show, Willing Participant, to the Adelaide Fringe before going to Canberra and then travelling, hopefully, all around Australia. Rob is an amazing raconteur. He's a very gentle man, and he thinks deeply about everything in his life, but he's also extremely funny, and this interview slash chat with him is full of the joy. It just makes you really happy, and anyone who will be heading down to the Adelaide Fringe or who already lives in Adelaide and is thinking that they might like to check it out, this will give you just a little nudge in the right direction. So I can't wait for you to hear this. Before we get into it, I just wanted to say to everyone, thank you so much for the fantastic response to The Ultimate, which has been playing on this feed. It's under the Beautiful Tales for the Disenchanted banner, and it's been an ongoing story that will probably end up around 33 chapters, I think, off the top of my head. We're getting to the business end of the story, and I have loved the feedback, and I have thoroughly loved the people who are trying to work out where it may land. So just wanted to take this opportunity to say thank you so much for listening, and also all your thoughts and ideas. It's really has brought a lot of joy to me for you to be participating and engaging with it in this regard. Coming up over the next few weeks, we'll be doing some best ofs. I will be going through my best ofs with TV and movies, etc. I never really understand why the best ofs always come out at the end of the year when shit's not finished. It drives me nuts. Like, you'll see a best of at the beginning of December when there's still stuff to experience. So I would rather do my best ofs a little bit later and be able to give you a full response. And there's also things like the latest season of Fargo. I'm classing that as a 2023 series. It's going to finish, you know, it's going to finish in this week, actually. It finishes tonight. So I want to get to the end of that and then see if it makes my top 10. Spoiler alert, I have a feeling it 100% will. But anyway, that will be coming up over the next few weeks as well. So we'll have some best ofs, we'll have some more guests, and we will finish off the ultimate and where that may land. So looking forward to that. And then also just a little reminder, if you are looking for some small blogs, I've set myself the goal of writing nice, concise blogs once a week this year, and you can find them at bigsquidpod.com. They're under the heading of Dispatches from the Fury Road. That's the name of the blog. Kind of sums up how I feel about the world in the title. And yeah, if you'd like to check that out, if you feel like, you know, you have a spare 4 or 5 minutes on public transport or waiting for someone, maybe that will appeal to you. All right, enough out of me. Let's get to the interview. I'll pop back to say goodbye. But in the meantime, sit back and thoroughly enjoy the wonderful Rob Carlton. So we've been friends for a long time now, and one of the things that is funny about being friends with you is that you've actually been in my life a lot longer than we've been friends. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've been watching you.
Not in a stalky way, like...
I'd be rapt. If I found out that you were stalking me, I'd be like, I'm doing something right. But it's I've been watching you on TV and in movies for such a long time, and I was like, well, where was the first time that I'd seen you perform? And then I had this vague memory, and I actually spoke to my mum because I was an avid watcher of a certain TV show when I was young. Do you want to take a guess where mum and I think we first saw you?
I'm going to guess a Country Practice.
Oh, no, not a Country Practice.
No, the reason I mentioned that, I got a message yesterday with the photo of me as a 14-year-old. I was 14 on a Country Practice.
Right.
And the girl who was in the scene with me was 13. She's now like a music star and lives just over there.
Oh, like, that is hilarious.
Anyway, so I've got these weird... What? Okay, so not that. So it wasn't, was it a Shelley's ad? One of the first ever ad I did when I was like 13, I was drinking Shelley's. It was the first lesson I got, Justin.
Yeah.
Not go hard on eating or drinking the product in the first scene of an ad. Because
really?
While orange fizzy drink for a 14-year-old was an attractive proposition at 9 a.m. on the first morning of shooting, by 12:30, let me assure you, I never wanted to see another orange bubbly fucker in my life.
Oh, great. Good for the potential diabetes in the future to have that lesson early. You know what? I actually saw an interview with Gary Oldman recently talking about his performance as Jackson Lamb in Slow Horses on Apple TV. And one of his pet peeves is people not eating and drinking. And he had a scene where he's eating ramen noodles. And he said that he ate like 13 or 14 bowls of it in this one scene. And I guess lucky for him, for people who haven't seen Slow Horses, Jackson Lamb is disgusting. So it kind of worked.
Oh, mate. But there is, yeah, people do that, and they avoid the food because of that repetition.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love it when good actors hoe into a big steak and you sit there going, oh, they're chewing, man. Their jaws would be stuffed after hours of filming that.
Well, that's a Brad Pitt move, isn't it? Like, there's so many movies where he's eating all the time. Mm. I guess he can get away with it because he's Brad Pitt.
I tell you what, yeah, we can get away with pretty much anything. There is something funny about, I really like eating in scenes. I find it heaps easier to act natural when you've got, you know, a stack of food in your gob.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. It's some sort of reptilian, everything's going to be fine. And it kind of relaxes your reactions for some reason.
Well, I guess because when someone says something, like, isn't one of the skills of acting, which people don't really talk about, is the ability to listen. So you react correctly to what's being said because it could come with a different intonation, etc. But if you're chewing, you're listening, but you also have to take into account you might gag on the food, or you have to swallow, or do you know what I mean? Is that just, does it kind of remove you from the acting?
Yeah, no, I don't know. It's one of those things. I mean, often when you say remove you, those little blocks can sometimes help you.
Yeah.
Little limitations inside a scene. So if you're kind of eating and then you suddenly have to respond to a slightly different thing and you've got a hurdle to overcome.
Yeah.
The human being under pressure is an extraordinary organism. It can navigate its way through so many different things. And so if you've got a couple of limitations, a couple of hurdles, that trying to speak while you've got a peanut butter sandwich in your mouth can sometimes, like the meaning can come through your eyes and your forehead. Oh, obviously my forehead. it can come through a different way. I mean, this is an oft-trod truth. Some people's best stage performances come when they're horribly hungover or unwell, feeling right. Under the weather. Because you arrive and you think, I can never get through this performance. But there's something about the stress of a human being getting through a story while under pressure that's utterly compelling. And every other element of your mindscape kind of goes away and focuses on the one thing that you've got to try and do. So it's a strange thing. Our limitations don't always hinder us.
Yeah, interesting. You know, before I get to this, before we get to this original TV series that Mum and I think we first saw you in, I also have to, my friend the playwright Melanie Tate would be aghast if I didn't ask you what your A Country Practice experience was like.
Oh, my Lord. Well, I started, so Country Practice was my very first drama, and it started auspiciously, I think you'll agree, Justin, where I was only 14, but I was still rather a malevolent threat. And while I wasn't a nasty guy, the suggestion was that I might be able to perform some nastiness on this young girl that's just run away from home. Oh. And that was, of course, the harbinger for most of my roles growing up, where I'm the nasty bastard on every single TV show. On A Country Practice, I just did that first bit. I think I played four different characters in A Country Practice over the years. I was a friend of Joe, played by Joe Mitchell. I think it was Joe Loveday in the show. Yeah. I broke my arm, and through the breaking of my arm, we discovered a murder.
Right.
Extraordinary stuff. I played a mad fellow called Budgie Markham, where a lot of my scenes were with Esme Watson.
That's great.
Oh, that was outstanding stuff. And who could ever forget my turn as the young Olympic hopeful cyclist that was struck down in the prime of his life with testicular cancer?
And oh, God.
They performed an orchidectomy. I don't need to tell you what that I don't need to tell you what that was. And I will, of course, they removed one of the testicles. And my favorite line ever, I think, from A Country Practice was after the procedure, he came up to my bed. He looked at me and he said, well, we have done that. And the testicle was sent to Burrigan for testing. And then the doctor assured me that while one was gone, I did have one left, and it would produce enough of the necessaries to compensate, I believe, was the line from the learned doctor.
Was that from the actor Shane Porteous?
No, it wasn't from Shane. I believe it was from the handsome younger Dr. Andrew Blackwell that came in shortly after Shane Porteous. But Shane Porteous, of course, one of the great Australian actors.
Oh, mate, that show was – that was appointment viewing for me. I was a Grant Dodwell fan. He was adorable, and Shane Withington as well. And
mate, Shane's a beauty. I'm still good friends with Shane.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's one of those fellows. But, yeah, that Country Practice was such great fun. So four or five different roles over the years turning up. It was just great practice, great legwork.
Well, according to your IMDb, you appeared in 11 episodes from 1985 to 1993. So they obviously spaced you out to make sure that they didn't go, wow, isn't that the same guy who was talking to Esme earlier?
Mate, the number of times I thought to myself, surely the Australian viewer is going to catch on to this little ruse. And I also did think, surely there's another actor that can play these roles, but apparently not. Years later, I actually... I played a couple of different characters in Water Rats, and extraordinarily, I'm sure you'll agree, I stormed the same police office twice as different characters, except the only difference being, I think, the first time I attacked it with a sawn-off shotgun, and the second time I came back, I had an axe.
Wow. It's like you went, I was too high-tech the first time. I'm going lo-fi this time.
Oh, I did. I think the first time was planned and the second time was a just an act of passion.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that explains an axe.
Ill thought out.
Yeah, just picking up whatever's around. Oh, this will do.
Well, there's an interesting connection too, because the second time I attacked the water rat's office was I was charged with disposing of a body improperly at sea.
Right.
Which sounds kind of odd, right? And it sounds like you'd never do that twice. Well, I have, because last year in the Channel 10 production of North Shore, while I didn't murder the young girl in question, I certainly disposed of her body improperly at sea.
Wow.
But, and in Sydney Harbour. So I don't think there's too many people with that feather in their cap, Justin.
Mate. through all these different characters, you're not learning any lessons.
Not a thing.
Yeah.
Not a thing. But I think that's the beauty of TV, isn't it? We plow on, we have our experience, we learn nothing, and we start again when we started.
Right, it's great. Well, you know what? This Mum and I think the first show that we saw you in, we are pretty certain it was E Street.
Oh, of course. Yeah, no, it was. It would have been E Street. And that. And again, look, I may have bashed up an old man in E Street, right? I may have done it, right? And it may have been in the unholy pursuit of a female that didn't want my attention. I grant you all of that. But let me ask you this, Justin Hamilton. As a Christian, should the Reverend Bob have kicked me out of E Street the way he did? Or should he have shown me a loving heart and said, look, you've beaten up an old man. You've pestered a woman beyond her means. But, mate, it looks like you are in need a little bit of love and you need a little bit of help. But did the Reverend Bob give me that? He gave me nothing, Justin. He kicked me out of E Street like the bum I was.
Man, like, you know what it probably was in the Reverend's case is that he was exhausted by the regular characters that he kept forgiving.
Mate, that's true. You think
he'd run out of empathy.
His forgiveness well had runneth dry.
Is it strange when you're a young actor and you're finding your way through the industry and you have these ideas of what you want to perform and then it's like, oh, I'm playing another thug?
Well, mate, it would have been hard if I didn't have the mother I had who, like, here's an example. My mum loves me to pieces and I love her. But not that long ago, she was staying up at my house and I'd woken up. I'm a late sleeper, as you know, and I'd come downstairs and my mother looked at me and she said, oh, good morning, darling. Good morning. She said, what are those dogs? What are those dogs that have too much skin for their faces? What are they called? I said, oh, a bloodhound, Mum. She said, yes, you look like a bloodhound.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And so so I grew up with a reasonably clear idea of the sort of fellow I was. Now, obviously, being called Robert, I always wanted to be a Robert Redford type actor. But having my mum, knowing my mum, knowing me, I was unlikely then to grow up under the illusion that I had Robert Redford's charms. And so when I started to play low-level thugs and criminals, as I got better at my craft and older and started really graduating into full-on murderers and the worse than that, it was no surprise that this face is one that the audience don't like.
Mate, this is, I reckon we're ready for a renaissance. I reckon we need to write a romantic comedy that is for grown-ups. A grown-up, like, you know, like a Neil Simon.
Yeah.
Dare I mention the name Woody Allen, kind of, Rob
too
Reiner.
Soon. Too soon.
But you know the type of movies I'm thinking about.
I do. Yeah, look, I'm up for that. Of course I'm up for that. I'd love to play a romantic lead, but I don't hold out too much hopes there, Justin. As you know, I was on Underbelly and they didn't ask me to get nude. So if you're not getting asked to get nude on the one show that asks everyone to get nude, I think that's sending a pretty clear message. The Australian public isn't ready for too much loving from this character here.
Are you turning up on the set totally nude and they're like, no, mate, you're good.
Oh, mate.
Back to the trailer.
Yeah, Have a three-piece suit, sir. Have a three-piece suit.
And you're like, oh, fuck, I've wasted a lot of money on this full body tan. Oh,
damn it. If you'd known that, I wouldn't have done the 50 push-ups just out there to try and get buffed on the arrival.
Yeah, I would have had a fucking sandwich 3 days ago. What was your first moment of like noticing an actor and as a kid? Because for me, like the first movie star I got into, which was, you know, to be honest, through Mum, was Steve McQueen. So we always used to watch Steve McQueen movies, Great Escape, Magnificent Seven, Bullet. Who was the first actor that you saw that you went, oh, that's what's happening, I like that person?
Look, the first thing that springs to mind as a question without notice is I guess I mentioned Robert Redford before, yeah. But it was by watching The Sting.
Oh, The Sting, yeah.
And there was just something about that movie that it just got me in, and there was a friendship and a loyalty and an honour.
Yeah.
And, you know, and obviously I was probably bewitched by Robert Redford's kind of, you know, sort of charm and extraordinary kind of guile and cool and a little bit of fuck you know, a bit of chin out. And then this, and of course, Newman playing that older role. And then the derring do throughout that show was quite stunning. The perceived breach of loyalty in that moment where you think the younger guy's dudded the older guy. And I was just heartbroken. I just remember being heartbroken. It's like, hang on, that's not the code.
Yeah.
That's not the code. And then for it all to be revealed the way it was revealed just left me so thrilled. And it was then, it was the preservation of the honor and the loyalty and the friendship that just made that story sing for me.
Yeah.
And there was an element too of, you know, taking down the rich fuckwit and their loyalty to their other friend who was shot earlier in the day. And that was an interesting, you know, early take on race relations.
Yes.
You know, and it would have hit harder in America, but, you know, to for over here, that African-American thing wasn't as political in my young eyes. But I just remember he was the kindest, most loving man. And for that to happen to him, I was just devastated. So yeah. I think that's that first the first memory of really kind of looking to actors and thinking, wow, man, they can take me places and take my heart places. And tell very, tell very sort of, and that one's a masculine story. And I know the world's full of masculine stories and things like that, but there was a tenderness to it
yes.
that really struck me.
Yeah, you are completely right. Like it might be masculine, but it is also a different type of masculinity. You know, it wasn't the typical kind of, you know, boys being boys kind of thing. No. There is a tenderness to it. It's so funny. I hadn't really thought about Robert Redford for no other reason other than I just hadn't really thought about him. And I was flicking through Netflix looking for something the other day and took a call. And you know, if you land on a movie, it'll kind of play a scene from it. And I finished it was a quick call. I finished and it was I'd landed on All the President's Men. And there is that scene. It's really early on when Robert Redford writes up an article and he puts it in for them to publish. And Dustin Hoffman's character just stands up, walks over, reads it and starts rewriting it. And Redford goes over and kind of asks him what he's doing. And Hoffman's like saying, you've made all these mistakes here, so I'm just making it better. And he's being Hoffman, you know, talking, and he hands it to Redford, who reads it, who's reading it. He's saying, look, you've made this mistake, you've made this mistake, you've made this mistake. But if you want to go with yours, we'll go with yours. And the way Redford just reads through it and he goes, no, yours is better. And it is, it's a masterclass of acting where, not for one instance did I not think he was reading it, that he's not listening to him, that Hoffman, like the whole scene is such a masterclass in acting. And
man, stuff like that too. And because the human being is, you know, we've evolved to this point in time. And the number one skill of a social being is to be aware of what's going on around you. And so as human beings, we've got these incredible receptors as to what's true and what's not, and what's playing out. And so when you're watching beautiful acting,
yeah.
A line as small as that, no, yours is better. To me, it's like a biopsy of the human spirit. You know, a great line can cut through, and what might be three or four words might be the most wonderful snapshot into the entire perspective of that particular character in that moment in time.
Oh, it's what a great way of putting it. But it's true, though. It gets that, it just gets to something that hits you on a subconscious level and spells it out. You were also in the film The Year My Voice Broke. Yeah. How old were you in that?
I was 15.
15.
15 years old. That was so exciting, man. Year My Voice Broke. End of year 10. So right. I started school when I was young. End of year 10, going into year 11. And so we were filming that out in Braidwood for some lunatic reason. I was there without a chaperone.
very different times.
All the young actors, we were living in this kind of, it's like a big, beautiful old homestead with big rooms, you know, big balconies and a big room each. And we just ran amok for a week or two when we were there. It was so much fun. Ben Mendelsohn was on it, Lo Carman, Noah Taylor, directed by John Digan, and a whole host of Australian classic actors that we all know, you know, but aren't necessarily household names. But as a young 15-year-old, the opportunity to go out, travel out to Braidwood, learn those lines. And again, I mean, let's look at the role I played, Justin. Utter fuckwit. utter fuckwit. My character was Pearden. I played, my fuckwit mate was Malseed. And we were named Pearden and Malseed because they were the dicks that John Digan went to school with, the guy that wrote it and directed it.
Right.
And so we were the fuckwit bullies.
Right.
And so in actual fact, that was just, again, if you look at the continuum of fuckwits I've played and then the justice meted out upon me. The justice, if I could remind you, was Ben Mendelsohn picking me up and giving me the classic royal flush.
Yes.
Where he picks me up and turns me up and dumps my head into... Oh, no, sorry. I'm giving Noah the royal flush.
The flush, yes.
I'm shoving his head down the dunny, and then Ben comes in, grabs us, gets me and my mate Mousy, gets us in a double headlock like that, runs us outside, and then takes us back here and then runs us headfirst into the wall. And that was super fun. So that was Benny Mendelsohn just smacking us. And it was great to see all those people. And, you know, I hadn't even seen Ben back then. He would have been 18.
Yeah.
Maybe. Man, he was electric.
Because I've been following his career for such a long time, the Mendelsohn Renaissance is one of the, you know, like, I don't know the guy, but I'm rapt. I'm really thrilled for him. And he kept turning up in so many big movies and I wouldn't be expecting it. It's like, Mendo, this is great.
Yeah, look, it's incredible. It really, really is. I mean, he's an extraordinary actor. And, you know, and he's been there or thereabouts for years and years and years. And then it's sort of they found him and he's got these amazing roles. And but there was a period there when, you know, he was doing guesties in Australian TV like the rest of us, hitting, you know, having to do commercials to get by. But, you know, it is a long distance game. I think Murray Bartlett, the New Zealander that won the awards for White Lotus, well, another great example. I was so excited for that guy. Like, that guy wasn't on anybody's radar.
Yeah.
And I didn't really know who he was. And then it came out, and it's like, wow, he's sort of my age. He's been around. He's been in LA, not really. So I know that story, and I know how hard it is. And then when I saw this guy do that role, I was just, like, so excited for him. Because I just thought he was wonderful and beautiful. And I also know what he had to do to keep himself sharp and alive for the decades where no one gave a shit.
Yes.
And then at that moment in time where the audition came up, that man was ready to pounce and he grabbed it.
Yeah.
Mike White from White Lotus saw that audition and said, he's my man.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, booyah, he's on. And it's just, a, you know,
star turn. Like, it's... Like, it's so funny, and there are, every time I think about that season of White Lotus, it is, it's like, everyone's great in that season, but it's his face that pops to the fore. And then you see him, like, the next thing I see him in was that one-off episode of The Last of Us, which is, once again, a masterclass in storytelling, because when he first turns up, you're like, oh, don't ruin Nick's world, you know, and then as it moves along, you're like, oh my God, I'm watching a romantic story in the middle of this zombie apocalypse tale. And he was once again so different as well. You're completely right that, and you know, the media is so obsessed with who's the new star, how did they break in, who's got the juice. But invariably, the most interesting people are the people who have been playing the long game. And it's almost like it takes a while for people to catch up. I know someone like Cillian Murphy has been around for a long time and been a star, but to see him as the face of a proper blockbuster, which just wasn't going to happen anytime soon, has been great to see. And it does kind of, it's in whatever job you do, it's a good thing to remember that if you just kind of stick to your guns, and when your opportunity comes, you will be ready to take
it. That's right, mate. Yeah. Like all of those things out and about, there's a thousand things you can't control, but the two things you can are rigor and manners.
Yeah.
And rigor and manners set you up for the long game.
Yeah.
Rigor means that you're going to be ready when the opportunity arises, and manners means you might get offered the opportunity.
Yes.
You know, if you've been rigorous and a fuckwit for 30 years, it's unlikely people are going to say, let's ring the fuckwit and give him a crack, right?
Oh, my God. It's like he's on the phone again.
Yeah.
He's at the door again. I can't cope with this. Do you have this might be an unfair question to ask you, but do you have a favourite role that you've performed?
Oh, yeah, I do. In terms of my favourite screen role, it was definitely playing Kerry Packer.
Yes.
In Paper Giants. And the reason being is because of the terror that it afforded me.
Right.
Like genuinely being frightened in the lead up to the role, genuinely thinking that I would be caught as a guy that couldn't act, because for the first time in my life, I was playing a character that everyone knew.
Right.
And they could look at it and go, well, mate, you were meant to be like that.
Yeah.
And you didn't do it. So that was, and then in terms of the actual story that we told, it's really interesting and it was fun. There was that father-son stuff that I love.
Yep.
And that's an ongoing theme and stuff that I explore in my own work a lot. There was the, also the sort of the high expectations and the fear of failure. It's a really fun area to play in, and that's what Kerry was going through as well. And then also, you know, the lonely person that everyone wants to know, that I think in the modern world is a really fascinating proposition. And it's not just about that notion of loneliness, you know, which was at the heart of my Packer performance, I think. The notion of loneliness in the modern world is such an extraordinary contradiction.
Mm.
And yet I think a lot of people do feel really alone in a time where the planet hasn't been more populated and there are more ways of reaching out.
Yeah.
But I think for those reasons, it was really artistically challenging and joyous, intellectually really fascinating, and emotionally utterly terrifying because of the skill challenges that I face. Interestingly, it's our mutual friend Adam Spencer that has a big part in me playing that role. And it was because, I won't get into the whole story, but at one point I discovered that I was in during the sort of the meet and greet process of maybe getting the role and auditioning for the role, I was pushing the production company away. I was busy with other things. And I thought I was also, you know, what would Packer do? But then I discovered actually the reason I'd been behaving like that was because I was terrified of getting the role. So there's all this subconscious fear hijacking my body, masquerading as courage and kind of bolshiness. And the moment I discovered that I was terrified of getting the role was the same moment I knew I had to do everything I could to get it because of fucking Adam Spencer. When we were at university together way back in the day, we made a promise to each other, which was to say yes to something that frightened the shit out of us at least once a year. And we made that commitment to each other when we were in our early 20s.
Right.
Because we figured, you know, let's do it. You know, we were doing a lot of fun things at uni. We were pushing the boundaries. We were having, you know, we were getting involved. There was a lot of crackly stuff going on. And we just wanted to keep that fun, rich, challenging vibe going. And I remember having this conversation really clearly with Adam. Say yes to something that frightens the shit out of you. And as you know, Justin, as you get older, it's harder to find things that frighten the shit out of you because we spend our lives organizing our life so that we're not frightened anymore.
Right.
And here I was in this hotel room overseas, suddenly realizing for the first time in a while, I was terrified.
Yeah.
And I remember that conversation with Spence from 20 odd years earlier. And I'm like, well, I'm fucked now. I've got to try and get, this job. Now, luckily enough, I did get the job and we got good results. You know, people like the show.
Mate, you're underselling it. You got great results. Before we go, because I want to talk to you about your new live show, but I'm just curious. So you said you were scared getting into the role of Kerry Packer. You've got to find that sweet spot between representing the person that everyone knows without it turning into caricature. Do you remember, was there a moment or was there something that helped you unlock the performance?
Completely. Yeah. Heaps of them. Yeah. Well, first of all, when you're that frightened, you do a huge amount of research.
Yeah.
Right. So I would talk to everyone. I'd read everything. I'd broken down. I had his voice in my ears the whole time through various stuff I'd got off the net. But there's one moment that really helped anchor me. And it was, that I embedded in as part of a process. It was this. Everybody knows the video. Well, not everybody, but a lot of people know the video of Kerry Packer where he's at the print media inquiry, and he's getting stuck into the politicians saying, you know, no, I'm not going to give you another dollar in tax because you as a government aren't good enough at spending it. You know, anybody that doesn't minimize their tax need to have their head read. That speech. Which I was always confused about. Everyone going, yeah, man, fucking yeah, good one for the common man. And I couldn't ever understand the ridiculous kind of intellectual kind of topsy-turviness of the fucking working man cheering on the billionaire for not paying his taxes. So, you know, a little bit of fuck off from me to that position. But the bit that unlocked the Packer for me, I looked at that bit on the net. Right.
Yeah.
And I was looking at it and then I was like, oh, so then I looked at the analytics of who posted that thing. And by some chance, I knew the person that posted the original post. So I got in touch with, fucking bizarre.
Wow.
I got in touch with that person. I said, look, you've just put a snippet up there. Do you have the full material? They said, I'll send it to you. So I had, it's like an hour and a half, 2 hours, the full piece of Kerry Packer giving evidence or, you know, appearing before the inquiry that day. So out of that, that's where I stripped all the audio out. So I had hours of his audio just in my head.
Right.
But right at the very, very beginning of that. So it's like raw files.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting there watching the raw files because you're trying to get people in uncharted moments where they're not sure they're being watched. You're looking for any kind of tiny little insight that offers you something true. So what's happening, Pack is there, he's sitting in the middle of the room and he's surrounded by politicians and then all over here there's fucking press and journalists and he's just getting the shits and he's getting more and more annoyed because of all the thing and he doesn't like all the cameras and he's just wanting to get a move on. And then he's actually said, come on, let's get a move on. You know, he's starting to bully him about a bit, saying, come on, let's get going. And he's standing there by himself. Oh, and he's got these glasses. Now, here's a bizarre one, mate. These are actually his glasses.
Right.
There's another, remember these ones? These are the glasses from that photo.
Yes.
This is another bizarre coincidence. My optometrist in Sydney happened to be his optometrist in Sydney. And when Packer died, the estate sent all of his glasses back to the optometrist, right? And so they had them all.
Right.
And they then sent them to me. Here's some of his.
Oh my God.
Right. I know. All these mad coincidences. So these are actually his, and these are the ones that he wore in the story I'm telling.
Wow.
But here's the moment. I'm getting to the bit.
No, I'm loving all of this.
Right. So what he's doing, he was sitting there and he had these glasses on perched over his things like that.
Yeah.
And
at the end of the nose.
I don't have the weight on anymore and, you know, and the hair, but kind of this sort of thing. And they said to him, could you please state your name and the capacity in which you appear? And he did this. My name is Kerry Francis Bullmore Packer, and I appear reluctantly. And that, for me, was the essence of it.
Great.
My name is Kerry Francis Bullmore Packer, and I don't want to fucking be here. And yeah. I don't want to be anywhere. I don't think he wanted to be in many places. And so what I would do, and because he was surrounded by people, everyone's staring at him, and he was one lone person in the middle of this room, and everyone wanted a bit. And he said that line. Yeah. So when I'm in my fat suit and I'm on set and I've got my hair back like this and I'm getting, because we're very different men, he and I. So when I got to work, I had to get in my fat suit and not talk to people. And I had to apologize beforehand because I like to chat and welcome people and stuff like that. But I just had to sit in my little zone. And this was after conversations with my amazing director, Dana Reed. So she said, do this. So what I would do, I'd sit there and you'd be waiting. And then it all gets set and you know they're about to say action. And just before they're about to say action, I'd sit there and I'd close my eyes and I'd breathe and I'd just say quietly to myself, my name is Kerry Francis Bullmore Packer and I appear reluctantly. And then I'd hear action and then you just fucking unload.
Wow. 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 That is magnificent. And that was your little, that was your Packer mantra.
Yeah, just something to kind of get back to basics, back to basics. And as I look back on it, it wasn't conscious at the time, but it's setting up these little processes, you know, like, I mean, the best example, of course, is Steve Smith. In fact, who'll just be starting his new career as a test opener moments away, Justin. Moments.
Yes.
But the process he goes through before facing every ball, boom, boom, left knee, right knee, box, right? Same yeah. with Rafa, and they have these little processes.
Yes.
So I think that was my version of that.
Mate, that is magnificent. I love all of that. How interesting as well. What a great thing to find.
Yeah, man. It was one of those things you're leaning in, you're going like, oh. And, you know, it could have sailed right by, but, yeah, there was just something the way he sat there, his body was leaned forward, his fucking neck out, those specs yeah. like that.
Yeah.
And I just looked at him and I thought, man, you've fucking lonely bastard.
Yeah.
Plus conniving, and I yeah. didn't believe a lot of what he said in that he was trying to convince him he didn't want this or that and wasn't control this or that. It was rubbish.
Yeah.
He was just bullshitting, but there you are.
And workers cheering on billionaires for not paying their taxes. Thank God we've learned from that time, and that hasn't continued until now, especially in American politics.
I know.
let's get to your live show that is going to be touring all over Australia, and at the end we'll give some dates, and I'll put them up at the website everyone can find them. Your new show is called Willing Participant. It is essentially four stories. Mm-hmm. The first story is from your early 20s, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So these stories I tell, so just to bring it back, these stories I've written over the years, and years ago there was a story club, Ben Jenkins and Zoe Norton
yes.
Lodge, just amazing. They invited me kindly to write some stories. And that was largely a comedy night.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Yes.
And I was looking at that form going, man, it is a comedy night, but I reckon there's room for some drama, you know,
yep.
like that audience is primed and they're there and they're listening and it's like, you know, and I reckon I can hold, you know, when you're on stage, you want to gag, you want to laugh, you're desperate for a laugh. But I was watching this audience and I thought, man, no, we are ready to build the stakes on this fucker. So this opening, the stories that I've written, for Story Club are now the stories of my one-man show. And right. So the structure of it is a bit different to stand-up. It's these story mechanisms in play. And so I'm building up the tension a little more than a stand-up comic might, because I know there's going to be a release.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, these stories came out of Story Club. I wrote them over the years. Then I sort of looked at them and thought, wow, man, I got four stories. They're all pretty cool, very funny, quite moving in yeah. parts as well. And I thought, gosh, how am I going to order them? And so I just ordered them chronologically.
Right.
The first story, as you say, is early 20s, then mid 20s, then mid 40s, and then a bit older than that. So it's really interesting. And then what I noticed there is there's these patterns occur.
Right.
Certain people, I mean, most everyone faces similar sorts of things at various age ranges. So the first story, early 20s, it's that time of life where you're just starting to come into that first time of life where you're actively choosing your friends.
Right.
You know, high school, you never chose your friends.
Yeah, primary school. Yeah.
They chose you. You know, if you're like anybody, like anyone, you just arrive with a lot of hope in your heart, hoping you're not going to be lonely at the end of the day, right?
Yeah.
And so these things trip on through high school, then you go high school, then university, it starts to get a little bit more active in who you're doing. And then in that early 20s, 20, 21, it's like, okay, I've got these people, I've chosen these people, but then you're like, oh, who are they?
Yeah.
I mean, people start revealing themselves. Christ, they're still revealing themselves to me today.
Yeah.
But this particular one was group of friends getting together. Somebody had done something. And we were all very interested in what that person had done.
Right.
And then we discovered at New Year's what they'd done. And so if you know anything about Sydney in January, it's ushered in by the five-day test match at the Sydney Cricket Ground.
Yes.
So this story, this person had done something. All of us decided we really needed to investigate it, you know, forensically. And we had 5 days at the cricket to do it. What had they done? My friend was having an affair with his cousin. His first cousin.
No.
First cousin. I know, you say cousin and everyone immediately looks for a happy out. Oh, you mean the second cousin? Cousin twice removed? No. My auntie's daughter.
Wow. So goodness.
I hope that sounds not too bad. I've just opened up a window.
That's great.
So I've opened up a window while at the same time Reg has started doing the lawn.
No, it's great.
It's a bugger.
No. It's adding texture to the podcast.
There you go. We want a little bit of texture, a little bit of grit for this particular story. So,
absolutely.
So he's doing that. And so anyway, effectively, look, it's a funny old story.
Yeah.
But I think at the heart of that particular one gets to that young time in our life where there's still, you're in your early 20s, you know, the beginning of the year is not till the end of January. You've got 5 days at the cricket and you're, really, do we put aside all this time, days, to go through crunchy hypotheticals and go, well, what do you reckon? You know, what do you reckon? While you're reading the book or doing the crossword, cheering the cricket, but you're there with your friends trying to figure out, we as a group,
yeah,
what do we all think about this? And it kind of captures that.
Magnificent. All right. I'm not going to ask any more questions because I want people to see it and discover more. So then, so you said it's early 20s and it's mid 20s.
Yeah. Second story is in my mid 20s. And that mid 20s for me, man, any mid 20s listeners out there, my love goes out to you guys and girls at the moment. It's, man, it's those first intimations of mortality. It's that first time in your life where $1,000 in your bank account's not going to see you to the end of your life.
Yeah.
It's that first time for me where you're like, wow, life's long. It was also the first time for me that I discovered that I'd become a man without any active decisions. I hadn't decided the man I wanted to be. I was just a bag of broken habits masquerading as a character.
Right.
And you go, right, well, who am I going to be and what am I going to be? So this particular story, I told a lie to get a job, which everyone's done.
Everyone.
Yeah. But the lie I told was I told it a film production company in Melbourne.
Yeah.
That I was a continuity expert, which is a head of department and a highly skilled, highly technical position on a film.
Yeah.
I was living in Los Angeles at the time. They flew me from Los Angeles to Melbourne, where I had to be a continuity expert on a feature film for a month.
Yeah.
And I had to learn the profession from a book on the 14 hours that I had going there. And so that particular story, I know, man, that was nuts.
That gives me so much anxiety.
Yeah, I know, right? But it's you're 25 and you're poor and you're hopeful and you're trying to make shit happen and you're going over here and things haven't worked out and you're looking over here. And what that really, really explores is the joy and the fun of that boldness, the agreeing to things that you've got no idea what you're agreeing to and just seeing what happens. But then this subtle thing that occurs in your mid-20s where you go, all right, I'm testing the bounds of bullshit just a little bit.
Yeah.
But at some point I'm going to become a bullshit artist.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know if I want to be that.
Right. Right.
So I'm going to test the bounds of bullshit, but what am I going to bring with it to suddenly? It's that toss of the coin. There's one line from the show. I think it's something like, and I better have my lines ready in a month's time when I step out on stage in Adelaide. But there's a line that goes something along the lines of, I believe one of the most compelling forces in any situation is legitimacy. If you know your stuff, you remain true, in the end, you will prevail. Ironically, to gain legitimacy, sometimes you've got to tell a little bit of bullshit.
Yeah.
Sometimes you've got to tell a lot. And so I think the mid-20s is that time of life where you're kind of half blagging, half catching up to yourself. And it can be real sliding doors moments right through that period. And I try and capture it with this story. And I hope I speak to a lot of those mid-20s people out there that are kind of feeling like the world's not recognizing them at the moment. And they're in a bit of a space and a bit of a crisis. And it can be really, really difficult. And this is a bit of a love letter to those people.
Such a beautiful thought process of that moment where you can make a decision to try something, but and it's probably a good thing that you try it, but it doesn't have to define you for the rest of your life. And look, to be honest, when you said I had to bullshit to get something, I thought, here we go. It's going to be Mark Ruffalo when he said he could ride a horse and then it turned out he couldn't ride a horse. Continuity guy on a feature-length film is unbelievable.
Mate, it was a whole month. I had to be that. I had to pretend to be that for a month.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. Anyway, it turns pretty wild, so I can't listen to the story.
So, yes, we'll leave that there.
It blows up.
Great. I can't wait to see that. So then it's a bit of a jump, and it's like early 40s, is that right?
That's right. So it's the next one happens in my early to mid-40s. So we jump forward 20 years in time, and it's this one, very different sort of story, and certainly a different sort of story in a comedy show. My father passed away in 2015, and in an effort to reconcile myself with his new form, which was ashes, I took his ashes on a bike ride. So I took, and again, it all plays out in the show, but it was just a sense. I loved my dad, and we got on really well. And this is a celebration, I guess, of what he offered me, an exploration of grief, and a celebration of gratitude, and it's a bit funny because when your dad's all stuffed in a little brick and you're used to him being the smartest, most intelligent, comforting, warm, like what do you do with a fucking brick now? Where do you put it in the car? What's this thing? And what's your relationship to it?
Yeah.
And then, of course, you're going through this extraordinary emotional upheaval yourself, full of laughter and love and tears and hope. And you're on a bike dressed in Lycra with your dad stuffed in a backpack on your back going down to your old where you used to live. It's It's kind of a tumbling, topsy-turvy memories of odd things that happened, things that he caught me doing, you know, back in my youth, things, you know. I discovered that grief doesn't wash away our less noble memories, Justin. And yes. So I discovered as I was riding my bike the various things that my dad had caught me doing in my youth, and there's some reflections on that.
Doesn't it kind of accentuate it sometimes?
Absolutely, and 100% entirely. And that story really starts looking, and I mentioned earlier about that father and son relationship that I explore. And that particular story then looks at, you know, my father's influence on me, and then my role as a father to my twin boys. Yeah. And I think I really love that area. And I really like that story because it's a kind, compassionate story about male strength, a certain sort of male strength.
Yeah.
Which was, from my father, a strength of dependability, of, no, a strength to let me be me.
Yeah.
A courage in recognizing that he couldn't control an outcome, and so the next best thing was to have faith in my ability to navigate my life. And yeah. I'll be forever grateful for the strength that he offered me through his trust in me, and his kindness to my mother, his respect of the family. He was away from the house for a long time, and when he came back, there wasn't a ripple in the house for the love and kindness he offered and the respect that he had for each of us.
Mm.
And it's a very different male strength than the one we often celebrate. And I know that there are a lot of beautiful men out in the world making homes, gentle and loving and the best they can be through compassion and hard work and dependability and loyalty and a lot of quiet things that we don't often associate with a male narrative at the moment. And so I'm really proud of that story, and I love that story because, you know, I think it speaks to the good in all of us. And I think we need wonderful male stories as much as we need wonderful everyone's stories, females. Yes. But this particular one is special to me.
There has to be diversity in the male stories. I think that's one of the things that people miss the point to. It can't all be. We need diversity amongst stories, and then within those stories, we need diversity within them. I was listening to an interview with Lisa Lopez, who is the creator, writer, and director of the new True Detective series with Jodie Foster.
Yeah.
And one of the things that she pointed out in this interview I was listening to is that Jodie Foster's character is a sheriff and a detective, and she's just really good at her job, and she's good at her job because of hard work. And it's not because she's brilliant, and it's not because she's on the spectrum of some sort. And she was saying that trope has been done to such an extent. Mm. I just wanted a woman who is really good at her job. Mm. And you know, she has other character traits, like she's kind of a bit awful in some ways, but she's just a hard worker. Mm. And it's like, even within that world, you know, there is a different kind of flavor. So to be able to have a male story that speaks to gentleness, I think, is paramount to our times now.
Absolutely. And certainly, you know, and as you say, the diversity of thought. I mean, there's a lot of male behaviors that have been appalling for so many years. Mm. You know, and I witnessed that. And again, I was lucky and blessed that I grew up in a house with a gentle father.
Yeah.
And so I my position on that, if you're going to pull it back and look at a societal debate, I think we have a lot of cautionary tales.
Mm.
Of male behavior, and they're necessary, but ultimately too, cautionary tales have a trail of shame.
Yes.
And I don't think shame is a motivational emotion.
Yeah.
And so we need other aspirational tales about men so that young boys that are growing into men know that there are other ways of being. You know, so we have the cautionary tales. You don't want to be like that. But, you know, here's a story about another man whom you might want to have a look at some of their behaviors and take on some of those. So my hope is that I'm just sort of adding to the very necessary multiplicity of dialogues on that conversation.
Yeah. And I'm also weirdly very attracted to stories about grief and overcoming them. You know, it is often through art that I've found ways to cope with grief in the real world and learned about grief as well. Like, you know, we lost our friend Cal Wilson last year, and there was I've been going through... It's people think it can be a linear thing that you deal with, but it's circles, and you go through these circles where you're dealing with it and it's really intense, and then you've hit a point where you've come to terms with it, and then you come back around and it hits you again, and it's like you have to now go through that process again, but the process is just slightly different. It's just something else that set the grief off, and then you just kind of keep going around in these circles until eventually there's a point where even if the grief never really leaves you, it becomes a part of you that you can know that the circle is going to turn soon, and it's going to get back to the part where it is all beautiful and it's all loving. And I think that's a really important story to tell as well.
Yeah, man. Yeah. And again, with Cal, I mean, she was such an extraordinary woman. I know you went through so much. So loads of love, man.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. All right. The last story. Late 40s, is that right, or is it mid-40s?
Yeah, this is late 40s now.
Yeah. Look at us in our 50s.
I know, right? Woohoo! So this story, how to play it? Like, it comes to that thing where I hadn't thought about it like this until just now, those challenges that we set for ourselves in our mid-20s that we must. Because we've got no money, we've got no career, we've got no trade, right? Yeah. And you've got to, you know, press yourself to get a leg up. This story in my late 40s is not that. This is taking on a new challenge. This is leaving a safe haven. This is... I've got everything set up and I know I can do that and I can make money. You know, I'm an actor and a writer and a director and producer, and I do these things. I host events, you know, I speak at things. But a new opportunity presented itself. And I got a phone call to audition for a musical. And that immediately was terrifying. I'm not known for my voice, but I also have always loved the theatre.
Right.
I've loved the emotions that musicals bring, although I'm not a constant musical goer. But I just thought to myself, you know what? This frightens the shit out of me.
Yes.
We've been there, right? We know the fucking rules.
Yeah.
So that particular story is about taking on a new challenge in your late 40s where you don't really have to, but you think life just might be a little bit more exciting if you add a tincture of terror to your days. And so that story goes through what that was like to take on that challenge and take on that audition. And the audience will have to come along to see how I fared. But again, it speaks to that notion of constantly challenging yourself and continually waking up going, right, have I got a bit lazy? You know, I think a lot of people wake up and wonder, fucking hell.
Yes.
This is all right, but where's that crackle? You know, where's the fucking booyah?
And it's a constant fear of mine. It's a constant fear of, I think it's hard sometimes to describe it because people often mistake what you're saying to mean that you're ungrateful, and you're not ungrateful, but there is a point where you can have certain jobs that make you feel comfortable. And I'm absolutely fearful of being so comfortable that it's 10 years' time and all my other skills have eroded because I've been happy to stay in this one place.
That's it. So rather than thinking of it, when people say, oh, you know, you don't want to be ungrateful, you go, no, 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 but nor do I want to take this for granted.
Yes.
And so it's like just by just turning up and just doing it and just servicing it, after a while you start taking it for granted. But the skills that got you there were about sharpening your blades with new opportunities as you move towards it. So I'm not going to take this for granted by just sitting here and repeating it. I got to start sharpening my blades and getting into that. But mate, here's the thing though, Justin, you must have that notion of staying alive, staying fresh, staying zippy. You're in this wonderful situation at the moment where you're getting your eyes and ears across all the bright young comics in the Australian scene, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how fun is that, dude?
Yeah.
I mean, that keeps you fucking honest and bright, these bright young things that are sharp and hungry. You get to see their vision and get it. I mean, I get so excited by meeting new talent. I mean, that must keep you pretty fresh, all these, you know, I mean, your listeners know how you're –
Yes, yeah, they know that I work on Question Everything, and you know, it's funny. Actually, both jobs, it does keep you sharp because you're getting their energy and you're seeing their youthfulness, and then working with them one on one, you're seeing what skills they don't have. So you get a lot of joy in helping develop those skills, but it also reminds you of the skills that you have that you should also keep sharp, and then. But funnily enough, of like the Question Everything side of things has been brilliant. But I work on The Chase Australia as well. Yeah, yeah. And the young quizzer, Mara, who's the smiling assassin. And she has been like a breath of fresh air for me because when she first started, you know, you have to be good at quizzes. They gave her a character that she had to play, but nobody really knew what the character was like. She had people fussing over her constantly, you know, people trying to get her look right. It was hard to get one-on-one time with her. She is absolutely brilliant. In the real world, she is brilliant. And she is also a chatterbox. And she's like she, and it's everything that's happening. She's, oh, I was doing this today, I was doing that today, I was doing this today. And then she'll point at me and go, you've got really good skin for a 50-year-old man, and kind of keeps talking. And they wanted to have her play a particular character, and I had to write lines to that character, but they weren't right. And so we had lunch a couple of times, and I got to know her. And then one day, I can remember the exact line that unlocked her on-camera personality, which was, we realized that she's totally unrelatable and she knows it, and that's funny. And so we had a guy who was talking to Larry about how he gets together with his mates and they like to compare craft beers. And I wrote a line for her as a smiling assassin to come out and say, your friends and my friends are exactly the same. You get together and compare craft beers. I get together with my friends and we compare Swiss chalets that we stayed at over summer. And then she looked at Larry and said, I'm totally relatable. Boom. There she was. There's the character. And like she, like we just knew that we'd unlock something. And, you know, it's good to be around young people and have that energy and be able to work together, help develop skills, and in the process they teach you where things are at that help keep you relevant as a writer and a comedian.
Keep you excited and as a person too. Engaged. And remembering that hunger.
Yeah.
You know, remembering the hunger. I mean, I got a lovely situation. I live up at Avoca Beach and I've got a wife that I love and I've got twin boys and all of those things. But you forget what it was like in those early 20s where you've fucking got to fight to be seen. Yeah. Fight to get a role. And one of the great joys I've had over the last, well, for a long, long time now, but I mean, really in the last sort of 18 months on different TV shows I've been working on, I was reflecting on this. I've been working with this extraordinary raft of amazing young talent. So on a show called Black Snow, I worked with a young woman called Talia and another guy called Josh McQueen and there's too many names on that show. Amazing young people. Then North Shore, again, bright young things. And Boy Swallows Universe, which just came out a couple of days ago. Again, working with a young woman, Sophie Wilde, who's amazing. Big world star right now. Another guy called Zach Burgess that plays the old. And then everyone's, of course, seen young Felix, who's playing Eli. But it was Zach Burgess, beautiful young man, 21 years old, crafting a real career for himself. And he was just telling me about how much work he was putting into his auditions. And I was, at the time, I just phoned an audition. Everyone's doing self-tapes these days, and they're a bit frustrating. And he was just telling me, oh, I've got to do this, I've got to do that, I've got to do... And he landed himself the lead in a big American TV show, and he's over there now making a stack of money. But it was just having lunch with this 21-year-old kid who was going, Robbie, you know, I've got to do this, got to do that. And I realised, man, I just phoned the last one in.
Yeah.
That's bullshit.
Yeah.
There's no way to behave.
Yeah.
That's taking shit for granted, mate.
Yeah.
Getting an opportunity and not putting it all in. And so sitting down with Zach and his lovely girlfriend, Leah, and I remembered that, and then an opportunity came up to do a retest for the one I just phoned in.
Yeah.
They wanted to do a callback. And it was American. And did I, so I rang Zach, right, and said, mate, I want you to come and help me and do this. So
great.
It's just the energy and the love. And again, this is what I'm loving mostly about Adelaide Fringe, where I'm about to arrive in a month. My business goal this year, Justin, is have as many interesting conversations with as many interesting people in as many interesting places as possible.
Yeah.
Right? That's my business goal. Adelaide Fringe, I can't tell you how excited I am to go over there and meet all the bright young things.
Yeah.
All the bright people that have been just practicing their craft and launching. This might be their first show, their second show. And then, of course, the people that have been there for years and years. I mean, your history with the Adelaide Fringe is just ridiculous. So I just can't wait to meet the bright young things and get all those ideas flapping around so that I can re-energize my 50-year-old brain into that period in the lead up to the mid-20s where you're still excited and electric and hopeful and optimistic and frustrated and, you know, and jam it all in so that I can continue making more one-man shows.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we get into promoting the shows, I would also be doing my mum a disservice if I didn't ask you about your working relationship with Travis Fimmel.
Travis Fimmel. I think...
Because this is the second thing you've worked together, isn't it?
We did three shows together this last 18 months.
I know,
every woman's dream. So, yeah, we worked together really closely on Black Snow.
Yes.
Where I'm one of the lead suspects, I guess you'd call me. And that was a beautiful show. South Sea Island story set here in Australia. Or an Australian story with that South Sea Island flavour. And, again, that was fascinating culturally. Worked with Travis on that. And look, that first little while with Trav was really, really interesting. He's a really interesting character. And really comes at his acting from a curious place. You never know what's going to happen with him.
Mm.
You never know which way he's going to do it. He really is a fruity unit, right? He's a fruity unit.
Yeah.
He turns up and he's got different things. He wants it to be interesting and unique. And the idea of doing something that's just phoned in is not on his radar at all. So you've got to stay alive. You've got to know your lines. You've got to know what's happening. You've got to know where you are in a scene. He's a star.
Right? Yeah.
He's a legitimate star. He turns out there's something about that face that's got fucking 40-watt lights coming out of those eyes.
Yeah.
And people are just drawn to him. You can't help but be drawn to him.
Yeah.
There's something about the crackle on the screen with that guy. And so... it was a very different way. Often you'd get together with that and you'd rehearse lines and you'd go through rehearsals. Trav doesn't work like that. He does his own rehearsal and his own homework and he's got notes all over his page and things like that. And then he comes in. But sometimes, you know, he can be in a real wrestle with the scene. And right through, there's not a sense of, oh, got this, got that. It's like, you know, he's not arriving going, come on, I've got this, bang, hoo hoo. I know exactly what's going to happen. He arrives. And it's like, man, this next hour and a half on this scene is going to be as surprising to you as it is to me.
Right.
It's like that. It's fucking, mate, it's Caesar at the Rubicon. Let the dice fly.
Right.
It's that, which is why you get that electricity in the scenes. And it's sometimes interesting to work with. You don't know how the scene's going to play out.
Yeah.
Because it, you know, there's been a stack of surprises throughout it. Now, personally, I like that.
Yes.
I'm comfortable with it. If I need something... you know, he was kind enough to then, you know, a couple of times, run some lines with me before I like to hear the words out of my mouth before I step in front of the camera, just to get it going a little bit. And so he was kind enough to, you know, join me with that. And we're very different men too, you know, I mean, Trav's not married. He's got his own business. He runs his beer company as well as being a worldwide star.
Yeah.
And being an extraordinary kind of guy. So we've got very different lives, very different men. But I think what might connect us is that we're both very emotionally driven.
Right.
Travis is emotionally driven. He's a heart connector guy. Although he can be, you know, he can kind of protect that as well. So that's a really interesting, and I think, again, that's what makes him more fascinating, is that he is all emotion. You can see that in his work, right? But there's also a sense of, you know, keep it here. And people love that. People like to try and pick behind the thing. So we made, so we got Black Snow was where we got to know each other. And then we were sort of Boy Swallows Universe, we were both in. And I saw him just the other day for the premiere of that. It was lovely to catch up. And then we were both in Court, and I didn't see him on Court. I had to spend the day with Sean Penn, sadly, so I missed my time with Travis. I know, name drop. Booyah. But so Travis on that. But if you haven't seen Court yet, man, watch Travis on that.
Right.
I reckon it's one of his best turns. He is fruity and funny and fully commits.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's not a sense of ego when you're watching that performance, because I thought he was hilarious. So yeah, that's Trav, man. I really I wish him all the best. He was over making Dune, I think, the TV series he was doing. Anyway, he's got so many shows coming out. And it'll just be fascinating to see what he does. But I think at heart, mate, he's a sweet guy from rural Victoria that wouldn't mind being back on his farm.
Yeah, yeah. He's a fascinating actor. One of the things that I think that people find fascinating about him overseas, which they probably don't quite recognise, but I think we recognise, is that there is a suburban Australian masculinity that is at both times can be feeling quite dangerous, but can also feel mildly camp. And I think, you know, his turn as Ragnar, where people are like, what is happening here? It's like, I feel like, I know he's playing a Viking from centuries ago, but I kind of know that guy because I grew up with him.
Wonderful part of the Venn diagram where the Viking meets the kid from Moorabbin.
Yeah. So that's great. Oh, I'm very happy to hear that. More importantly, I'm very happy to hear about your new show. I think it's going to be stunning. Even the way you described it, as a guy who loves structure, it feels so right. Where can people see the show, and also what sites can they go to book tickets and find out more information?
Yeah, wonderful. So I'm on at Adelaide Fringe Festival. I'm there starting on the opening night of the Fringe, which is February 16th, Friday, February 16th. That's the show I'd love everyone to come to because it's my first show and I'd like some numbers. But yeah. I am there for 2.5 weeks. So February 16th to March the 1st. I'm at the Holden Street Theatres.
That's right, yeah.
In the Arch. And the Holden Street Theatres, just about 5 minutes outside the CBD.
Yeah.
But it's a little cluster of theatres. There's like four venues there. It's got a great history with the Fringe. It's a little arts precinct in and of itself. So there's other shows to see when you get there. They've got some great part of the program. They've got these funny little Shakespeare bits that they do, which are all comedy. Just a wonderful little area set up by another extraordinary Australian performer, a woman called Martha Lott.
Yes.
Now, Martha is extraordinary in her own right in that, you know, she's a creative director, artistic director. She's pretty much the producer of that place and has just finished starring in one of their shows. So, I mean, I don't know where she finds time in the day to do it. I mean, she was up last night looking at my poster, for example. So an amazing woman running that program out there.
The Holden Street Theatres, for anyone outside of South Australia, is an icon and is a beautiful place to perform and is so important to the festival and the Adelaide theatrical culture. So it's such a great place for your show to be performing.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I'm super excited. I'm in the Arch. It's a beautiful old sort of church-type theatre, I think, and I can't wait to get there. Grabbing tickets. You Google my name, Rob Carlton, willing participant. You go to the Adelaide Fringe website and it's all there. You clickety-click. If you jump on my Insta site, I'm just learning this stuff, Justin. I don't mind telling you how fucking
It's a lot.
With the times I am. So Instagram, I'm at Robbie J. Carlton. You can put that up there. Who cares? Facebook's the same, but there's links, those little link trees or bio links, and you can click on that, and it's all there.
Excellent.
It's a super cheap show. It's like $30, $25, something like that. And I just can't wait to see people out there and connect these stories. What I find with the stories I tell, I have done this show, and the thing that I'm proudest of, I guess, is that I've had any people from, you know, 15, 18 years old right through to 80 sitting side by side laughing and crying and coming out. And one fella said to me, I did it down here at my local theatre, and this fella I've known for a little while up here, he's a plumber, came up to me. He says, Robbie, thanks so much, mate. I haven't been to the theatre much. He said, but that was great. I feel like I've just watched four movies in my head.
Yeah, great.
And it was like, all right, I'll take that.
Yeah, absolutely. And then after the Adelaide Fringe, are you?
After Adelaide Fringe, I'm down to Canberra Comedy Festival.
Yep.
So one night only, March the 23rd at Canberra. Can't wait to get back down there. Now, that's actually an encore performance. I did the same show in Canberra last year. This is basically my first. The Adelaide Fringe is my first real foray into setting up a tour for the year. So I'm doing Adelaide, I'm doing Canberra, and then I got to figure out what to do next and how I go. So keep an eye out for dates, but I'm really looking at I got to get to Melbourne at some point. I got to get to Sydney, and I really love the regions. Man, I love doing little tours around the place because I fill my car. I got my surfboards and my bicycles and my chair. It's just me and a chair on a stage. And I can fang around and hit my stories and meet people. I love driving and seeing little towns. So who knows where I'll go.
Oh, I'd love to see you do a tour, you know, go everywhere from Broome up to Rockhampton. You could do all those beautiful theatres. It'd be fantastic.
Mate, all you need to do is send me your diary so I know where all those bloody locations are. No one knows that stuff better than you.
I'm more than happy to help you with that. Hey, let's get the Adelaide Fringe going and then come back and tell us what you've learned from the show and how it's changed. And, you know, I think there's maybe 700 other shows that we can talk about.
Absolutely.
But thanks for being on the podcast. You're a gentleman, and that kindness that you talked about coming from your father, it permeates your soul. So thanks for being on the podcast, and I can't wait to talk to you again soon.
Take care, man. Loads of love.
Thanks, mate. How great was that? He's fantastic, right? I just had such a good time, and hearing all those stories was magnificent. And as he even stated at one point, it's like I didn't give him a heads up with anything, you know? So all I said was, I'll probably talk about your career and we'll talk about your show. And if he can do that off the top of his head, imagine how great his show is going to be. So please go and check that out at the Adelaide Fringe. It was also directed by the brilliant Darren Gilshannon. I think that's how you pronounce his last name. I've read it for so long and then I suddenly was like, how do you say it? But it will be an absolute beauty, and I think you'll get so many different flavours from it. You'll get comedy, you'll get drama, you'll get deep explorations of pure emotion, and then it'll be silly. Like, it's just kind of what you want from a live show. So if you're in Adelaide, please go and check that out, and then he will be back in Canberra as well. I'll put the link for the Adelaide shows up on, you know, Facebook and, you know, all the places that you can find me. You know where you can find me. So I'll put them up there for you so it makes it easier for you to go and check out his show. Okay. Once again, thank you for all your support. I hope the year has started well for you. I have found this year to be, I was saying on stage last night at the Enmore Theatre, that normally at the beginning of the year, you have that energy. It's like, boom, it's the start of the year. Let's get to work. And at the start of this year, I was like, fucking hell, do I have to do January again? And then I was thinking about all the other months. Oh, do I have to do July? Oh, October. Fuck off, October. Anyway, I've been working through that just by doing little bits and pieces here and little bits and pieces there and slowly finding the creative spark inside of me again and getting a little bit of energy into me. So I feel like things are on the upswing, and you're one of those reasons. The podcast allows me to reconnect with people, and I don't take that for granted. So thank you very much for being you. Thank you very much for your support. I hope you're well, and I will be back again next week with a couple more podcasts and blogs for you, and hopefully some announcements of some gigs. We're starting to look at gigs, so I'll let you know about that. I'm at the Comedy Store, actually, this Thursday to Saturday. That is the 18th to the 20th of January, so if you're around, feel free to come and say hi. Otherwise, I will see you at some point in the year. Take care. Until then.
We're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.